You are listening to the Brighton Book Club Footnotes. I'm joined in our virtual studio by Eliza Clark, whose new book, Boy Parts, is out now with Influx Press. I read this book in 1.2 days over the weekend, which hasn't happened in years. And it's not particularly short, and I absolutely loved it. And I was really happy when Eliza said she would come and talk to me and do a deep dive into this really exciting debut novel. So welcome to the show, Eliza.
Hi.
Can you describe Boy Parts in one sentence? How would you describe Boy Parts?
Oh God, like a plot summary or like a vibe summary?
Okay, let's do a vibe summary and then a plot summary.
Okay, I suppose I feel like it's always easiest to do just the kind of lazy comparison to other authors, but think of your sort of a Tessa Moshfeghi via Newcastle for the vibe. Maybe a little bit of kind of a little bit of American Psycho mixed in, I guess.
Yeah, definitely.
And yeah, for the plot summary, it's about a photographer called Irina who has returned to her native Newcastle after her career's kind of failure at a launch in London, which she's very bitter about. And she gets put on sabbatical at her dead end bar job and kind of goes a little bit crackers after coming into contact with a young man that works in a Tesco that she sort of gets obsessed with and tries to photograph for a potentially career reviving exhibition back in London.
So we are so used to seeing women basically objectified in art, and there's a lot of like art references in the book, which we'll talk about in a minute. And there was something like sadistically refreshing about seeing men objectified. And so what Irina does is she takes kind of explicit photos, would you say, of blokes who she finds interesting, who she hands her business card out to on the streets. And it's all kind of above board, like there's consent forms and stuff, but it often gets pretty weird. And there are times when it kind of spirals out of control and you feel like she is not in control of these photo shoots anymore. What were your main inspirations for using this as like a large part of the plot?
Fortunately, I do have an art degree myself, and I was kind of a little bit, I don't know, I think I was always a little bit of a rubbish artist. Like I was really interested in photography, but I've never really had the proverbial bollocks to like actually go up to somebody and ask if I could take their photograph. So I would have like a lot of like interesting ideas that I'd just never really like be able to execute because I was just too shy. But I was really, really interested in the theory around photography and, the theory around photography, the theory around the like the problem of the female nude I was really interested in, which is essentially the idea that you can't really protect images of the female body from the male gaze. So you can never really have like a neutral image of a woman's body because it'll always to somebody end up kind of being sexualized or eroticized. So I was really interested in that. When sort of around the time that I started writing the book, I went on holiday to Berlin and I'd never been before, and I just sort of happened to go to this Helmut Newton exhibition. And Helmut Newton's like this, he worked for Vogue a lot, and his entire oeuvre is just like, it's just like really, really attractive women nude, sometimes being sort of terrorized by an animal or something like that, but largely it's just really, really attractive women that are nude. And like all of the captions in this exhibition were like talking about his photography, like it was something I was supposed to be fucking impressed by. It was just sort of like in it would have been 2018 at that point. And yeah, and I just kind of couldn't believe that in like 2018 we were talking about this art like there was anything, like anything at all valuable about it, when it was just like clearly just some kind of horny dude taking photos of hot women, and they were like technically competent, but it was just like, God, I just don't care. And it made me so annoyed that I think I was like, this started out as a short story, but like a really long short story, and I sat on the plane home and just, I think I just tapped like 2,000 words into my notes app.
Wow.
I was so irritated by this exhibition that got kind of funneled into Boy Parts. But yeah, I'm just kind of very interested in like photography in general, and there are a lot of like female and queer photographers that I was really interested in, and the way they kind of subvert that work, but and kind of how they could almost be what Irina's work could be if she had like even a scrap of empathy.
Yeah, she actually, her lack of empathy, I mean, it's so weirdly refreshing. Like I read a review today in the iPaper of this book, which is glowing, so congratulations, and it said and it was something like it reading this book feels like sitting in a pub next to Irina while she just tells you about her life, and it is all from her point of view. So you get these snippets, but there is just like zero self-awareness, but also like very few fucks given. And it's so nice to actually read a book with a kind of psychopathic female protagonist that just doesn't give a shit and knows she's hot. But that must have been so fun to write. And how did she come to you?
Yeah, it was really fun to write, actually. It was when I started writing it, she was a lot more like, I really like monologues. I've just always been very attracted to the monologue as like a form. So I kind of basically wrote it as this like weird extended monologue. And originally our voice was a lot more, it was still kind of callous and like nasty, but it was more like mine, in that she was very like self-deprecating and a lot more like self-aware. Speaking as somebody who is just chronically self-aware. So I had it kind of like this, and I was part of a mentoring program with New Writing North at the time. And my mentor, who was Matt Wasilowski, who wrote the Six Stories books, right, sort of just kind of read it, and he was like, the voice is really strong, but I think you need to kind of strip out the self-doubt stuff, because I think it'll just make her a bit more coherent as a character. It'll make her less relatable, but it'll make her more coherent. Mm-hmm. So I just basically did that, and it did make it make a lot more sense. And that was just kind of a big thing that was kept in mind throughout the whole process of writing the novel, when it was a lot longer, obviously, was to just kind of strip out that sort of self-doubt and self-awareness, and have it kind of like almost niggling at the back of her mind, but never like
doesn't quite break through.
Yeah.
Do you think that this book would have worked? So part of Irina is that she is kind of completely beautiful. She's right, very tall and commanding and like dangerously thin. Do you think boy parts would have worked if she was average looking?
I'm not sure it would have. I think it probably would have added this like weird extra layer of comedy to it, I suppose, if she was incredibly confident about the way that she looked, but was quite plain. But no, I think sort of an important theme is like the idea of being looked at, and I think she really struggles to be looked at. I think she likes looking, and I just feel like in kind of our society, like nobody gets looked at more than beautiful women. And I feel like there's such this like weird taboo around women discussing their own beauty and having like a relationship with their own beauty and being aware of their own beauty. It just seems like something that people find incredibly off-putting, and like, I don't know, it's something that people are very hostile to, the idea that women are like aware that they're attractive.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And also there's so much as well of what she actually gets away with. Like there's one scene where she's I'm gonna try and say this without giving away too much, sitting opposite a man at a restaurant and literally telling him that she has done something completely illegal and absolutely not okay. And he just kind of smiles and nods and thinks she's quirky because she's hot, right? Like she can almost do whatever the hell she wants because she's really hot.
Yeah, pretty much. There's something in psychology called the halo effect, which just if you're not familiar with it, it's basically just the idea that people who are very attractive kind of walk through life with this halo effect where everybody's kind of nice to them, and like maybe the bus driver lets you on for free, and maybe you get something free at Pret, and people smile at you and hold doors open for you. And the idea that people kind of just sort of float through life getting like better employment opportunities and better grades in some cases. Yeah. But there's also something called the reverse halo effect, which kind of pretty much exclusively applies to women, which is just something that they've noted in the court system. So attractive women that commit crimes that aren't related to how attractive they are actually get sentenced a lot lighter. So say you're really pretty and you've been stealing stuff, then you're probably going to get a lighter sentence. But say, yeah, really pretty, and you've been scamming men on the internet with how pretty you are and getting them to give you all your money, you're going to get a really harsh sentence.
No, that is fascinating.
Yeah, so people are like, it's also been noted with like women with other women that sometimes you'll find that other women will become very hostile to attractive women because they kind of see them as a threat. It doesn't tend to happen as much with men, apparently, but yeah. And I think it's something that I've kind of noted in like my own life, I suppose, that when people are attracted to you, I think they sort of come up with an idea of how they want you to be. Mm-hmm. And then if you disappoint them, they can become really, really aggressive and really, really hostile. And it's always been that weird like snap change that I've seen in men when I haven't given them the response that they wanted, that I found really like interesting and something that I wanted to explore.
Yeah, absolutely. That is so, and that's something that just isn't really, you're right, like isn't really spoken about. Right, so something that I'm really interested in as someone that's from the North and the South is like the North-South divide. And I'm really interested in this in publishing in general and books and writing. And like, I think, you know, there's obviously moves at the moment in the current situation to make everything less kind of London centric. And there's a lot in Boy Parts about, so Irina goes back to back up north where she's from. And there's a lot about class and the kind of assumption that you're working class because you're from up north, and then coming to London, you know, thinking that you're middle class, coming to London and realizing you're working class. Can you talk a little bit about that? And like, does that come from your experience, because obviously you've lived in both places?
Yeah, completely. I'm obviously kind of like, I've been a little bit touchy about sort of discussing the autobiographical aspects of the book, because obviously I've never killed anybody. I'm generally quite a nice person. But the North-South stuff's just kind of very like drawn from our own experience of sort of going down to art school and being like kind of shocked that I'd be like the only person in the room with a regional accent, and shocked that I was one of a handful of people on my course that had been a state school and was from outside London, because we had like a few more working class people that were from London, because I think London institutions can be more accessible to working class people based in London just because they're geographically close to it, if that makes sense. But there was just almost nobody there from like above the Watford gap. Wow. If they were like very middle class, and you kind of couldn't really tell. So it was just sort of a bit of a like, it's just kind of like a very strange experience. Like I had like a tutor, he was like very nice, but he once sort of cheerfully told me that he'd like never been above Cambridge, and I just sort of thought like, okay, I don't know what you want me to do with this information, apart from be like, well, maybe you should fucking go above Cambridge then. It's like nice.
Yeah, there's a lot more space. It's really pretty.
You should probably like go to Manchester. I've heard it's quite like lively.
Yeah, there's art in Manchester, man. Come on. So you are published by Influx, who are an independent publisher, and you've got a bit of a background in kind of working. You've worked for Dyslexia, and which is a great writing magazine. Did you always know that Boy Parts would find its best home with an independent press?
I did have that sense. I think I did the sort of round of submissions for agents early on, kind of sort of being aware that I didn't think it was gonna get picked up. Like I thought it was just basically like, I know that this is good, but I don't know if it's the kind of thing that a literary agent would immediately want to take a risk on. Particularly with us, to be fair, my manuscript was a little bit less polished when I was sending it around to agents, but I would say like not that much less polished. So I kind of had gotten to a point with agents where I kind of thought, why am I even bothering when there are like really good independent presses? Like I immediately had Influx earmarked. I had 404 as somebody that I definitely wanted to look at, and Dead Ink as well. Like these were all kind of, they did feel like very obvious choices, and like they'd work really well for me. So I was obviously really pleased when Influx did want to take it.
Yeah, I think there's we speak quite a lot about this on the podcast anyway, and I work for a couple of independents, and it's just like the risks that they can take more risks, and they can find the audiences for things in a way that the bigger kind of houses maybe don't have like the time or the inclination to do, because people are loving boy parts.
Yeah.
But it, you know, there's something about indie presses and knowing how to get books out there straight to readers.
Yeah, I think as well, it's almost like, I feel like it's not even so much that indie presses are like willing to take risks. It's that the traditional and sort of wider publishing industry is so risk averse, to the point of just like to the point of creative cowardice in a lot of senses, I think. And that there's like it, like I sort of, I don't know, when you kind of look at sort of the response that Boy Parts has had, I don't really think it was like a risk to take it, but to a sort of big press it would be like a huge risk. Which is it, I don't know, it's just, it's sort of funny. I just kind of wish that, I think it's happening more now that you're seeing kind of places sort of gravitate away from London, and then you've obviously got imprints like Dialogue and Picador, which have been doing like good work for a really long time and are publishing like very interesting writers. But yeah, I just really think the publishing industry just really kind of needs to pull its head out of its arse. Like I said this in the Guardian interview that I did, but I just think it's absolutely ridiculous that I should be like a diverse voice in publishing.
Yes.
Like I think it's really silly that like I'm a university educated white woman that lives in London, and but because I'm like from the north and I've got an accent and I went to state school and I'm from quite a working class background, I'm like, ooh, what's this?
Yeah.
Diversity.
It is absolutely mental. I've always said it, publishing is the slowest industry to accept change, and I think it's because like I don't know, I think music and film and TV, although they still have work to do, there's always a kind of striving for you know, inclusion, but publishing is just drags its heels in everything.
Yeah, I think it's because the film and TV industry have sort of got the double-edged sword of the visibility. So if your cast or your crew is very white, people can like see it, whereas publishing can kind of get away with it just through like literal lack of visibility.
yeah there's no group photos in publishing. Absolutely, and it's something that every publisher has work that they can do. Most publishers have work that they can do. Right, I want to talk a little bit about sexuality and sex in the book, and how you there's a kind of really, there's such a detachment of intimacy in the book, and was that something that you really consciously did, or did that just come to you because, you know, as you got to know Arena as a character?
Yeah, I think I am. I really enjoy writing like a really uncomfortable sex scene.
Yeah,
it just sort of, I don't know, I feel like that's just something really like visceral about being able to write sex in a way that's really uncomfortable and like difficult to read. So I sort of knew that I wanted to do something like that, and I think the way that I kind of found more out about Irina, I thought, you know, this woman's gotta have like an absolutely huge problem with intimacy and kind of very little understanding of consent, and that was sort of the way that I approached it, really, of just somebody who's like very, very frightened of like her own body and the fact that she has a body and that it's embarrassing and gross and the fact that other people are embarrassing and gross and the fact that, I don't know, she's like aging and dying.
Yeah, the aging stuff. I'm exactly the same age as her and I was like, oh no, I really related to it.
it's weird how like visceral it can be to like age as a woman. It shouldn't be. But there's like that feeling of like, I mean, I'm only 26 and like sometimes I look in the mirror and I just think, God, my eyes are sinking in the back of my head. I look like a skull because I had a bad night's sleep. And so I just sort of sort of wanted that. I have this like extreme discomfort and obsession with bodies at the same time. And like I said, just a kind of very, very lack of grasp of consent as a concept.
Yeah. Their sex scenes are amazingly uncomfortable. I was gasping. My housemates were like, "What are you reading?" And I was like, "I actually can't." The scene with the tampon, I think I'm quite hard to shock. And I was like, "I actually can't believe someone's written this. This is amazing."
Yeah, that was to keep things completely anonymous. That was an anecdote that a friend told me about someone they knew, and it was actually their version of the anecdote was much worse. So it's like it just basically the concept of the tampon was retained, but yeah, their the actual real life version of that is like rank.
I've got my jaw is open.
Yeah, she told me about it, and I was like, "That's the most disgusting thing I've ever heard. I'm probably going to use it at some point." Sorry.
I hope whoever did it in real life reads this and feels very seen. What are you working on now? Do you have a new book in the pipeline?
Yes. So I'm with Influx for a 2-book deal. So mm-hmm. my next book is expected in 2022. Mm-hmm. I'll be a bit vague about it because I'm just concerned that I'm gonna like change my mind. I've actually changed my mind about what my next book's gonna be already, so I'm thinking something that'll sort of be a bit of a departure from Boy Parts, but will still have a sort of, hopefully we'll scratch the same itches that people who enjoyed Boy Parts have.
There was someone, I saw you tweet that someone had described it as covered in piss, which I thought was such a funny review.
Yeah, I think that was Alice Slater's sort of little vox pop on it, that it was absolutely horrible, can't look away, car crash of high heels and bloody feet, red wine and blood splatters, trendy galleries and toilet cubicles covered in piss.
Oh, amazing. That is such a good way to describe it, and actually probably quite a good note for us to end on. Eliza, how can we find and follow you, and how can we get a copy of the book?
So I am at Fancy Eliza on Twitter and Instagram. You can get the book either directly from Influx, from your local independent bookshop. You can also get it from chain shops as well. And it's also available on Audible. And I read the audiobook myself. So if you didn't find this too grating, then that's an option.
Oh, that's so cool. I'm so glad I might actually listen to it as well. Obsessed.
I've heard it's good.
Have you listened to it all the way through?
No, I haven't, but I just honestly, my boyfriend accidentally played like 5 seconds of it and I was like, turn it off. So I haven't quite managed to muster up listening to it yet, but I've heard it's a good audiobook. I personally always really enjoy an audiobook that's read by the author.
I love it. Yeah.
Donna Tartt reading The Secret History is amazing. So yeah, that is an option for you.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.